Before he could finish, my dagger skittered to the other side of the room. Shocked, I froze, one hand at Nick's temple, my heart suddenly pounding in my chest as I watched it spin in the far corner.
"Too late," Nick muttered.
Swallowing down a thick rise of fear, I glanced beside me at the booted foot that had kicked my dagger into the corner, and the shapeshifter it belonged to. Golden eyes glowed. Gabriel. My heart began to thud. Improved sparring skills or not, I felt as puny and weak as ever, huddled on the ground before a man who was peaked enough to make the air prickly with his magic.
"It was me," he confirmed.
He'd done this? To Nick? One of his own pack members? I tried to play catch-up, but couldn't make sense of it. What could Nick have done that would prompt Gabriel to this kind of violence? Without words, Gabriel walked to the door and flipped on the overhead fixture with a loud click, flooding the room with light. I blinked back white spots, then stood up and looked him over. His knuckles were raw, and a bruise bloomed over his right cheekbone. Nick had gotten in a hit then, but had ultimately been bested by the alpha in the room. And here I was in a room with him, my colleagues miles away, my dagger on the other side of the room. It was time to use the only weapon I had left, a good, old-fashioned vampire bluff. I adopted the haughtiest tone I could muster. "What did you do to him?" Gabriel arched an eyebrow, as if surprised I'd challenged his authority, his right to deal with a member of his pack as he saw fit. After a moment of staring at me, he turned and slid a chair out from the table, then sat down. His posture was negligent, slouchy, legs sprawled, one elbow propped on the table. I wasn't sure if he was really that unconcerned that a vampire had just walked into, well, something, or if it was some kind of ploy.
"You lied to me, Merritt."
"Excuse me?" Gabriel crossed his legs at the ankles, then traced a circle on the tabletop with the fingertip. My skin began to itch with the pins and needles effect of his magic. I fought to hold back my fangs and the silvering of my eyes, even as genetics screamed out, "Run, or prepare to fight, now."
"You told me you learned of the contract on my life because you'd received an anonymous phone call."
He looked up at me, the color in his irises swirling with obvious fury.
"That was a lie."
I met his penetrating gaze with a neutral expression. Gabriel bobbed his head toward Nick. "In fact, I've learned Mr. Breckenridge here was your not-so-anonymous source, a man with whom you've had a lengthy personal relationship." I frowned at Gabriel. Nick had given me the information because he'd gotten an anonymous phone call. And yes, I had a personal relationship with Nick, but in high school. Confused, I glanced at Nick, who shook his head.
"He thinks I did it. Thinks I planned it. The hits. The attempts on his life."
"You did have the knowledge," Gabriel said dryly.
Nick barked out a strangled laugh.
"With all due respect, Apex, I'm a goddamn reporter. I get tips. It's my job."
"He was trying to help you," I added. "He told me so I could pass along the warning, so you'd know there was a risk of a hit at the conference. That's why we told you. That's why we were prepared when the chaos started."
"I'm now regretting that I called the convocation, that I didn't just pull the shifters back to Aurora. One shifter, a leader, is dead, and now there's a division between the rest of them. Do you have any idea how frustrated that makes me? When I trusted you?"
Given the angry magic in the air and the sulfurous smell of it, I had a pretty good sense of it. "Nick didn't do this. He couldn't have done this. You know he does everything possible to protect you, to protect the pack. Do you recall a few weeks ago when he tried to bring down our house because he had just a suspicion that we might harm shifters? And you have no right to question my or Ethan's motivations after what we've done this week."
"We know what you call us," Gabriel said. "Pretenders."
I lifted my eyebrows. "I don't call you that. Ethan doesn't call you that. And even if there are vampires who use that term, we certainly don't have a monopoly on prejudice.
There are plenty of shifters with some grade-A hatred of vampires. Nick used to be one of those shifters, and here I was protecting him.
You lied to me. I do not take kindly to treachery, Merritt. I do not take kindly to being set up. Why should I let you escape with impunity?
Screw this, I thought, and darted for the dagger. Gabe let me get it. He didn't lift toe one from the floor as I came back and stood in front of Nicholas, weapon in hand. I moved around, keeping my body and blade between Gabriel and Nick. It's not that I had a lot of lost love for Nick, but Gabriel was higher up on my shit list at this point. I was going to have to figure out what was going on, but I was damn sure going to do it with steel in my hand. Don't come any closer, I warned him. My dagger tipped out toward his chest. I don't want to have to hurt you. He grinned at me, wolfishly.
I'm amused you think you could hurt me, Merritt. You fought some shifters, sure, but they weren't alphas.
As if to prove his point, he stood up and threw out a hand. I think he meant to casually disarm me, to push the dagger from my hand, but he underestimated my speed. I slashed at him and made contact, a crimson line appearing across his forearm. His eyes instantaneously widened, and he looked down, surprised that I'd done it, but still not intimidated. I, on the other hand, was feeling pretty damned intimidated.
As you'll no doubt recall, I got shot yesterday. This is only a scratch. I'll just have Berna bring in a Band-Aid.
Berna, he called out, his head half-tilted back toward the door. There was no answer. She's not out there, I told him. The bar's empty.
The bar's not empty, he said. They're still working out there.
Berna! Gabriel yelled again, but his call was met with silence. He looked back at me, bewilderment in his expression. The pieces fell together.
Adam, I whispered.
Gabriel's voice wavered.
What about Adam?
He picked me up at the house in a limousine and drove me here. He said you wanted to talk to me. He showed me a text message you sent. He dropped me off and said he was going to circle the block to give us a few minutes to talk.
I didn't send a text message.
I get that now. I think he set us up. I looked at Gabriel. Did he tell you that Nick and I set you up? There was a flash of alarm in Gabriel's golden eyes, at least until he closed them again, his expression haggard.
He said you two were working together to create problems for me in Chicago.
He glanced at Nick.
He said he had proof you were going to use your family's money to put yourself in charge of the pack.
Nicholas scoffed and looked away.
I would never, never. He is my brother, Gabriel added quietly, frustration in his voice,
as if willing Nick to understand why he trusted Adam, even if the story was a little too soap operatic to be entirely believable. I assume he was trying to get you pissed at me and Nick, I said. Maybe so you'd incapacitate us or just take us out altogether.
And then what? And then he tries to take me out while you're here.
And they'll think I did it, I finished for him. Adam will take me out and claim he caught me in the act of killing you. And that's the first shot in the war between shifters and vampires. I softened my voice.
Gabriel, if you didn't call me here, why else would he have arranged for me to come?
While Gabriel considered my question, I considered the fortuity that had put me outside the house. What if I hadn't been there? Would he have come into the house looking for Ethan? Would Ethan have been drawn into the trap? Did he tell you Ethan was in on it? I asked. Gabriel nodded, and then, as if the weight of his brother's betrayal had suddenly hit him, his eyelids fell shut.
Dear God,
he said, shaking his head, as he puzzled it out.
You're right. Why else would he have arranged for you to come?
Could he have been behind all of it? I asked. Tony's death? The attack on the bar? The convocation? The hit? I mean, he is your brother.
I would assume that's the motivation. He's family. He's in line for the position of Alpha, but last in line. He must want the position, and I'm the current obstacle to that plan. Not the only obstacle, since Fallon and the rest of them fall in line before Adam.
but a current obstacle. He swore out a string of insults that reddened my ears and made Nick whimper from his spot on the floor.
He killed an apex, for Christ's sake.
Gabriel crossed himself, two fingertips moving from head to heart, then across his chest, as if protecting himself from the karmic backlash that Adam's mortal wound would have incited. Or perhaps apologizing to the universe for it.
He's good, I said quietly.
He never directly implicated Tony, but he pointed us in the right direction so that we implicated him ourselves,
which made the idea that much more believable.
I nodded, then glanced around. If Adam was still circling the block, waiting for Gabriel to take me out, we were going to need a plan, and fast. Is there another way out of here?
He shook his head. There's a fire exit, but it's through that door on the other side of the bar.
I blew out of breath, squeezing and re-squeezing the dagger's handle. We'd been set up, and some really, really bad shit was going to go down in this bar in Ukrainian village. Better yet, no one knew I was here, and I didn't have a phone on me. Adam had a phone, the little shit, but a fat a lot of good that was going to do me now. I tried to slow the hammering of my heart and hold back the silvering of my eyes. I did not want to be stuck in the back of a bar with no exit. I felt like the stupid heroine in a horror movie, willingly walking into the lion's den without phone or sword, now stuck in a family squabble between Apex and his cane-like brother. Backup, I figured, was my only bet. I could call Luke or Ethan or even Jonah and report that Adam was trying to take us out.
Do you have a phone?
Behind the bar, Gabe said.
As we glanced at the red leather door that led back into the bar, preparing to make our move, the bell over the front door rang.
He's back, Gabriel said.
My effort to hold them back notwithstanding, my fangs descended and my eyes silvered. The blood began to rush through my veins as my body prepared for the fight.
Sire, Nick called out. Please.
Gabriel moved to Nick, put a hand behind his head, and pressed his lips to Nick's forehead. He whispered something I couldn't hear, but his words were low and earnestly spoken. Then Gabriel glanced back at me, as if my presence affected whatever answer he was going to give Nick's plea.
Shift, he said. And do it quickly. I don't know how much time we'll have.
Nick closed his eyes in relief and began the slow process of standing.
No vampire sees this and lives, Gabriel said, his voice gravelly. I allow it now because one of my own put you in this position. But you saw none of it.
I nodded, even if I hadn't taken his words to heart. The expression in his eyes signaled clearly enough that he was trusting me with something momentous. The right to watch a shapeshifter work his personal magic.
Sir, I said, recognizing his authority.
When Gabriel nodded and turned back for the door, the first line of defense against Adam's coming back, I risked a glance at Nick. He'd stripped off his t-shirt, revealing a fuzzy but bruised chest, and was pulling off his jeans. Not expecting the show. Weren't shifters supposed to rip through their clothes? I turned away again, but not before Nick had caught me inadvertently peeking.
It's not entirely necessary to strip down, I heard him say as fabric fell to the floor. But these are my favorite jeans.
I bobbed my head in understanding, but kept my eyes averted.
If you want to see it, Nick quietly offered, you'd better look now.
The only vampire alive to see a man shift into something. No way was I going to miss that. I glanced back, catching the full Monty of a very naked and well-honed journalist. He had athletic feet, long, lean calves, and firm thighs. His shoulders were strong, his arms muscular, but he was also bumped and bruised, cut and bitten. He'd clearly taken a beating at Gabriel's hands. Nick nodded, and then it began, and my mouth gaped open in shock. It wasn't what I'd expected. I'd seen Underworld and the rest of the movies that detailed the transformation from human to wolf. I'd assumed the change was a physical one, a gory shifting of muscle and bone, an exchange of paws and fur for human skin and feet. but there was nothing anatomical about this. I raised a hand to shield my eyes as light flashed around Nick's body, a cloud of shifting colors as the magic, thick enough to take tangible form, swirled around him. I'd always thought, as was the common vampire understanding, that shifters were like us. Super predators who'd come into existence as the result of a genetic mutation that altered the form of their bodies. That's not what this was. This was gentle light and a haze of color. Shifters were predators, only secondarily. First and foremost, they were magic. Clean, pure, inherent magic. Not like us. Gabriel turned to face me, his amber eyes alight with predatory arrogance, but the emotion softened. I shook my head.
I've seen that look before, Merritt. It's neither as good nor as bad as you think.
I looked back at Nick, who was still wrapped in the fog of it, invisible through the mist that cocooned him. And then the mist changed shape, from the tall, lean form of a man into something low, something horizontal. And when he padded toward me through that mist, low and feline, a sleek, black cat, cougar, jaguar, puma, in the middle of a bar in Chicago, my heart nearly stopped. He was tall, his head high enough to reach my elbow, his coat so sleek and black that he gleamed like velvet beneath the overhead light. His paws heavy, big enough to take a chunk out of a vampire, should he feel the urge. There was no mistaking his power. There was also no mistaking his health. Where Nick had been beaten and bruised, the cat was healthy. Maybe that's why he'd asked to shift, so he could heal himself and lose the bumps and bruises. And maybe that was why he'd had to ask, because Gabriel had prevented his recuperation. They might have imagined themselves to be casual, relaxed, less strategic and anxiety-ridden than vampires. But there was assuredly a hierarchy in the shifter food chain, and hierarchy mattered. Nicholas padded toward me and nuzzled his face at my thigh. "Now who's kitten?" I murmured, and although the low, grumbly sound he made was decidedly feline, it was still sarcastic.
"All right, children, let's get ready for showtime. Breckenridge, take care of Merritt."
He lifted his gaze to me.
"You'll be a soldier, a warrior, someday, when you're ready. That's the legacy of you and yours. You nicked me, even without your steel. But he is my brother. This is my fight, my family's fight, so I'm asking you to defer."
"You don't want my help?"
Gabe barked out a laugh. "I am Apex, and he's kin. This is the natural order of things, the way our world operates. There's nothing you can do but get hurt and get Sullivan pissed at me. In the event I survive this, I would sure like to avoid that."
My heart stuttered, but I was smart enough to take his advice, at least until honor required me to intervene. I looked around the room and decided on a table that sat in one corner, the stack of cards from the poker game atop it. I crawled beneath it, a vampire hiding from a fight. Sure, it was a little humiliating, but I too was hoping to walk out alive. Nick followed me, then turned and arranged his haunches on the floor, putting himself between me and the door. A few hundred pounds of now feline shifter between me and whatever hell was about to break loose. Gabriel began the methodical practice of stripping off his own clothes, the muscles of his body taut beneath them. When he was done and stood naked before the door, he crossed his arms, and we waited. When Adam finally pushed open the door to the back room, there was shock in his expression. I decided not to take it as a compliment that he was surprised I was still alive.
"What happened in here?"
he asked haltingly. He was scrambling, I imagined, to analyze the situation, to figure out whether there was a way to salvage the script he'd developed or whether he needed to write a new ending.
"I'm still alive," Gabriel pointed out.
"Nick is also alive,
as is Merritt. Everybody wave."
I skipped the wave, but offered up a lip-curling snarl, which I directed at the boy who'd led me right into a trap. A trap he'd created.
So just give me the basic refresher, Gabriel said.
The point was, what? To take out Tony? Frame him for the attack on the bar and have me assassinated? And when that didn't work, you decide to take me out yourself? Take out Merritt? Frame her for my murder? And assume control of the pack?
He crossed his arms over his chest.
And when that's all said and done, what? You take on the houses and lead the packs into genocidal glory?
Adam's features hardened, his lips pulling into a thin line, and then his eyes darkened, and he stepped onto his soapbox.
And what have you done for us? We have meetings while vampires are treated like celebrities. They control the spin. We're a part of this world, one with this world like nothing else in existence. But we act like children running behind their mother's skirts.
I had to admit, that speech wasn't exactly hard to come by these days. Although the shifters at the convocation hadn't made it, Selena and her cronies had. It was the same argument made by vampires who wanted power in the human world. I'd heard Selena say it, and 2 weeks ago I'd heard Peter Spencer make the same argument.
The pack acts like the pack, Gabriel countered. We do not exist to control the fates of humans or vampires. We control our fate, and that's enough.
Not when we could do more. Being supernatural was clearly no immunity against the weakness of the ego.
Leading this pack is not about power, Gabriel earnestly said, as if we'd been thinking the same thing. It's not about ego or wearing the mantle of leadership. I think Dad would have disagreed.
A pulse of chilling magic filled the air. I guess Gabriel hadn't been thrilled about Adams bringing their father into it.
Dad is no longer here. I speak for the pack now.
Adam rolled his eyes.
You hardly speak at all. And that's exactly my point, brother. We both know why I'm here. Let's get it over with. I have things to do.
The pressure in the room suddenly changed, as if the force of the magic they had brought to bear had altered the atmosphere. And that difference was enough to make my ears ache. And then they shifted. The light was brighter than it had been when Nick transformed, maybe because Gabriel was an apex and Adam shared some of those genetics. Nick let out a low growl and bumped back closer to me until his back haunch hit my knees. I'm not sure if the move was made to protect me or because he was as nervous as I was. Too curious to resist, I reached out a hand and stroked his flank, which felt like thick velvet stretched over taut muscle. He flinched at the contact, but settled into it soon enough. The mist rose again, surrounding Adam and Gabe, and then sank as they shifted, Adam's clothing apparently evaporating with the force of the magic. They were enormous, and our intel had been correct. They were wolves, both of them, and huge. They were easily bigger than Nick, and both had thick, steel-gray fur and pale green eyes. Their bodies were almost barrel-like, their muzzles pointy, their ears flat against their heads as they prepared to battle. Adam was a little smaller than Gabriel, maybe because he was younger. He also had a white mark on his left shoulder, which was otherwise the only way to tell them apart as they moved. And move they did. They made their first strike simultaneously, both of them standing on back legs to swipe at each other with their front paws. Their jaws were bared, lips pulled back to reveal thick white teeth. They jumped for a moment before hitting all four legs again, Adam in a lower position. Maybe a recognition of his submissiveness to Gabriel, before apparently deciding that the time had passed for that submissiveness. With a high, keening cry, he pounced, teeth and claws at Gabriel's shoulders. Gabriel scrambled to recover, but not before blood was seeping from a wound at his shoulder. He let out a high-pitched cry that made me clamp my hands over my ears, before the whine turned into a canine-bearing growl. He rolled, taking Adam with him, then kicked Adam with enough force to propel him across the room. And as if the sights and sounds weren't enough, each time they lunged, they sent a pulse of magic into the air that made it hard to suck in oxygen.
My senses, already on edge, were nearly overwhelmed. This wasn't just two wolves play-fighting to assert their dominance. This was a battle of magical forces, powerful magical forces, for control over the pack and its members, and the future of shifters. Gabriel represented the status quo. Adam represented a much, much different future. Adam stood up again, shook off the force of the impact, and, with high tail, hackles raised, and ears flat, attacked. He tried to best Gabriel again, blood-tipped teeth snapping at the larger wolf's muzzle, but Gabriel wouldn't give in. He scrambled to lose Adam from his hold, then made his own move for dominance, pinning Adam to the ground and snapping at Adam's snout. Adam yipped in pain, the sound more like that of a puppy than an oversized wolf, but Gabriel didn't yield. Adam scrambled beneath him, trying to reverse their positions, but Gabe rotated as Adam moved, canines bared and emitting throaty growls to keep the dominant position. Like grappling cage fighters, they continued that way for a while, chair sliding as they tousled across the floor of the back room and the linoleum beginning to bear the bloody marks of their fight. Adam wouldn't give up, but neither would Gabriel give ground. I wondered if Gabe had fought this fight before, and how many times he'd had to battle to keep his hold on the apex position, or to keep order in the pack. Adam made one final attempt at the crown, running to the far side of the room as if to regroup, then bounding toward Gabriel with the strength he had left. There couldn't have been much left in him. They'd been grappling for 10 or 15 minutes, and Adam bore the brunt of the fighting. His once thick, flat gray coat was now matted and bare in places, blood seeping from wounds on his face, neck, and front legs. But he came at Gabriel again, 2-inch-long canines nipping at Gabe's snout as Adam tried to push him to the floor. Gabriel yipped at the contact, but managed to maneuver his legs enough to get them beneath Adam's torso and push him again. This time, Adam squarely hit the thick wooden leg of a side table on the other side of the room. The vase of plastic flowers above it toppled, and the wood cracked as the table leg splintered with the impact. Adam, still on his side, tail now tucked submissively between his legs, whimpered. He was alive, but he lost his quest for the pack. I wondered what fate awaited him. Nick paced forward a few feet, and with another burst of flashbulb-worthy magic, shifted back into human form. Gabriel did the same, scratches and punctures still evident on his face and arms. I climbed out from under the table, ever the brave vampire, and dusted off my pants. The room was quiet while they dressed again, slipping into jeans and t-shirts, then socks and shoes. Gabriel's gestures were simple and efficient, and I wondered if the act of redressing was a kind of meditation for him, a process of readjusting to the human world and his human form after time spent in the body of the wolf. When Nick was dressed, he moved back to me. "You all right?" he asked, scanning my face. I nodded, then shifted my gaze to Gabriel. "The shifting didn't heal him," I whispered. "Only wounds taken on as a human can be healed by shifting. Wounds taken on as a shifter are costlier. He'll heal eventually, but there's no quick fix." Gabriel, now dressed, offered Nick and me nods of acknowledgement, then moved toward his now prone brother. He crouched down on one knee and stared into Adam's eyes. Adam, still on his side, whimpered again. "Change," Gabriel commanded. I had just a moment to raise my hand against the sudden light. When I blinked again, Adam lay on the floor, naked and curled, his body a mess of cuts and bruises. "You are a disappointment to me, to the family, to the pack," Gabriel said. Magic rose again in the room, but not the energetic buzz from before. This magic was old, heavy, and oppressive. Although it had nothing to do with me, my lungs burned with the effort of pushing in and out the air made heavy with the weight and consequence of Gabriel's disappointment. There was no missing it. "You don't choose to be Apex," he told Adam. "The pack chooses you. Being Apex isn't about power or wealth or status. It's about family and commitment. Lessons that I have, apparently, failed to teach you.
There was melancholy in his voice as he took on part of the burden of Adam's actions.
Being Apex isn't about taking charge. It sure as hell is not about endangering family.
And if you'd have taken me out, what then?
Fallon is next in line, not you. And I know she has strength and sense enough to hold the pack.
You are at the bottom of the ladder of succession, my boy. And while I might have wondered if you could prove yourself stronger than the rest of them, this proves to me that you will never be fit.
Gabriel rose again, then stared absently across the room, a decision seeming to weigh on his mind. After a minute of silence, he sighed.
You are responsible for the death of a pack leader.
I will not, cannot, given the vows I made to our father, take you out, despite the pain and embarrassment you have caused.
Gabriel shook his head, resignation in his eyes.
And maybe you'll be lucky. Maybe the members of the Great Northwestern won't either. But it will be their decision to make.
Gabriel! Adam hoarsely pled, but Gabriel shook him off.
You will present yourself to the members of the Great Northwestern, and they will decide your fate. And if you're unwilling to go of your own accord, I'll ship you in a crate, if that's what it takes to get you there.
Adam's fate apparently decided. Gabriel blew out a breath that seemed to push the weight of the world off his shoulders, then glanced at me.
Seems I owe you another goddamn apology for bringing you into another pack dispute.
I don't care for owing apologies. I'll have someone call Sullivan so he's briefed when you get back. I'm guessing if he doesn't get that debriefing, you'll be spending the next 2 hours in his office, replaying events.
I nodded. That's pretty much how it seems to work.
And when he does ask you for your version of events, how much are you going to tell him?
I gave the question some serious consideration. There was no way I was going to lie to Ethan. But omission? Maybe. Especially if I explained to him why I was omitting certain details. I'll tell him only the things he needs to know, I answered honestly. Gabriel seemed satisfied by that.
Good enough. Although he's going to shit about this, about your being involved in something this goddamn stupid and dangerous.
I'm an asset, I said remorsefully. If he gets pissed, it's because you've endangered his weapon.
Merritt, if you really believe that, I've been giving you way too much credit.
His expression was serious enough to put surprise in mine.
Then he has an odd way of showing it. Babe, he's a vampire.
Why did everyone keep saying that? I'd been about to ask for a ride home when my beeper sounded. Curious, I unclipped it and glanced down. It read, Cadogan, breach, attack, 911. I stared at the message. It took a moment to wrap my brain around the content. And then, what should have been obvious from the first, dawned. There'd been a breach, an attack on Cadogan House. Oh God, I said, my mind suddenly racing. Then I looked at Adam.
What did you do?
Merritt,
Gabriel asked, but I put up a hand and kept my gaze on his brother.
Adam, what did you do?
He looked back over his shoulder, meanness in his eyes.
It's too late. The plan was in place. I already sent them to attack.
My heart nearly stopped. Even Gabriel paled.
You sent who?
Shifters? Some humans? Those who wanted to take down the vamps a few notches.
Oh God, I said. There's a party going on. They're outside the house, unprotected. I've got to get back.
Okay, Gabriel said. Nick, keep an eye on Adam and call the pack.
And my grandfather, I put in.
Get as many to Hyde Park as you can. I've got my bike. We'll get you back and we'll stop this.
God willing, we still could. Chapter 24, Bringing Down the House. It was a good thing it wasn't yet close to dawn, since my way home was open air. I took a moment to use the bar phone and put in a quick call of my own while Gabriel prepped his bike.
By the time I made my way outside, he sat on an Indian motorcycle, a low and long line of gleaming chrome, black studded leather, and silver enamel. I pulled the extra helmet from the back of the bike, then swung a leg over.
You ever ridden before?
Not in a while, I said. Gabriel snorted, then revved up the engine.
Then I suggest you hold on tight.
I pulled on the helmet, climbed on, and wrapped my hands around his waist.
Not quite that tight, kitten. We're only going to Hyde Park.
Sorry, sorry. The bike thundered, a hollow, rumbly sound. But even over the din of it, I thought I heard him mutter, "Vampires." 10 terrifying minutes later, on a trip that should have taken 20, we made it back to Hyde Park. Gabriel drove as if the fires of hell were on his tail. From the column of smoke we could see rising from the neighborhood, even blocks away, I worried they were. The street was riotous. Trucks and bikes were parked in the middle, probably to keep out the cops, who were nowhere to be seen. But the paparazzi were plentiful, snapping pictures of the vehicles and the shifters that emerged from them. And, more important, from the smoke that billowed from the first floor of the house. My chest felt hollow. I was the sentinel. This was my house. And I had been tricked into leaving it unsecured, leaving the vampires inside unsecured. God, please let them be safe, I prayed, whipping my dagger from its sheath and jumping off before Gabriel had time to come to a full stop. He called after me, but I was already running, dagger in hand. I made it only steps before a shifter came at me, bearing a katana that had probably been pilfered from one of our vampires. My vampish ire rising quickly and fiercely. I dropped to one knee, fangs descended, and forced the attacker to vault over me. As he stumbled through the air, I stuck an elbow up into his chest and yanked the katana from his loosened grip. I stood up again and rolled the katana in my hand, its weight comforting even if it wasn't my own. I turned on the man, who'd rolled to a stop, but in the most inconvenient location, at the boots of the apex predator of the North American Central Pack.
I got this one, kitten, Gabe said, his narrow-eyed gaze on the shifter before him.
I hope the man had sense enough to stay down. With a nod of acknowledgement, I set off at a run, katana before me, sirens finally ringing out behind me. It was the fire department, I hoped, if I was still going to have a place to bed down before sunrise. As I slashed at two more attacking shifters, I tried to quiet my mind enough to connect to Ethan. But although I called his name twice, then three times, I couldn't find him. He wouldn't answer me back. I made my way through the marauders to the house's front gate and found Luke there with two fairies, the three of them battling back the crowd of shifters who were trying to push through. Given the smoke, some must have made it, or else they'd snuck over the wall on other parts of the grounds. Luke, I called out, giving an attacker a foot to the chin and watching him crumple. Luke glanced around.
Sentinel, thank God! Some of them are humans, but I think the rest are shifters. They attacked the house.
I had to yell over the din of sirens and clanging steel.
It was Adam. He had a plan. We'll talk about it later. Is everyone okay?
I don't know. We left Lacey at the back of the house with Lindsay. Ethan, Juliet, Kelly, and Malik are inside.
Merritt!
I glanced behind me. Catcher, Jeff, and my grandfather, his gait a little slower, moved toward us amongst the dark-clad cops who were finally beginning to emerge from cars and wrangle the perpetrators together. That raised a good question. How in God's name were we going to explain this to the cops? I guess that was my grandfather's department.
Just worry about your duties, my grandfather said, as if anticipating the question. Nick called and explained. We'll get this calmed down out here. You do what you need to do to keep your people safe.
I nodded, then pointed a finger at Jeff. You ready to fight? He grinned wildly.
Tam Skippy?
Then let's do this. We moved inside the gate, my borrowed katana in hand and a shifter at my side. They swarmed us as we entered, half of them bearing the electric sizzle of agitated shifters, but none of them in animal form.
Why haven't they shifted? I asked him, raising the katana and preparing to strike.
Paparazzi, he said, which made sense.
Jeff bounced on his heels, fists curled. It was an odd-looking position for the lanky computer programmer, but I knew Jeff could take care of himself.
And unlike the convocation, where we'd fought on different sides of the room, this time I got to watch. While I fought off the perps on the right, Jeff took the left. And he brought it. It was like watching a monk do battle, complete calm in his expression and his eyes. But every move perfect, every move precise. He was a fantastic fighter. His strikes and kicks on target and his blocks perfectly timed to defend against the blows of his attackers. At one point, he caught my stunned gaze and offered back a cheeky grin.
Sorry, babe, I'm taken.
I rolled my eyes and swung my katana, and together we fought back the army of people and shifters hell-bent on destroying our house. I'd taken down 4 attackers when I finally heard his answering call in my head.
Merritt?
I said a silent thank you to the universe. Ethan, where are you?
First floor, my office. Get here if you can. If not, find Malik and keep him safe.
My stomach sank. Malik was basically Ethan's vice president, the vampire charged with taking over the house if anything happened to Ethan. Had Ethan given up? Was he already trying to establish a line of succession? I bit out a curse that should have blistered Jeff's ears.
Stay where you are, I told him. I'm on my way.
Merritt!
I am the sentinel of this house, Ethan. It's my call.
That was met with silence.
Jeff, Ethan's in trouble. I need to get inside. Can you find Malik and make sure he's okay?
Hands are full, Merritt, he said, using a strike to the chest to push someone back.
Can you wait until we've secured the front yard?
I glanced around, wondering how much longer that would take, and smiled. I'd made the call, and the cavalry had arrived. 6 of them strode into the gate in black and red leather jackets, Noah at the front, 5 other vampires behind. Together, they looked like avenging angels, katanas bared, expressions fierce, ready to fight for vampire kind. Jonah wasn't among them, and I assumed he'd skip the fight so he could maintain his anonymity as a member of the Red Guard. Some of the tension left my shoulders at the sight of them. Noah signaled that they'd take the outside perimeter. When I nodded my agreement, he began to bark orders at the rest of his crew. They broke formation and dispersed into the crowd.
Merritt, to your left!
At Jeff's warning, I immediately threw up my katana to block the attack. The perp's blow was deflected, and Jeff's punch to the guy's kidneys brought him down.
Fun, fun, he said, smiling down at his fallen prey.
Yep, I said, leaning forward to kiss him on the cheek. You and Fallon are gonna get along just fine. With that, I mounted the stairs and headed into the house. Gray smoke was now spilling down from the 2nd floor, vampires evacuating as firemen ran down the hallway, hoses in hand. One of them paused on his way up the stairs and lifted his hood.
Ma'am, you need to evacuate.
Vampire, I yelled out. I'm immortal.
He winked at me.
Gray house, he said,
then flipped down his hood and proceeded up the stairs with his comrades.
Carry on, my friend, I said,
then hustled down the hallway to Ethan's office. His suit coat was discarded, spots of blood and smears of smoke in a sharp contrast against the white of his shirt. He stood at the back of the room, the office's velvet curtains now shredded and smoking behind him, a fan of 4 shifters in front of him. But even the direness of the situation couldn't trump my relief at seeing him hearty and hale.
Need some help, Sullivan?
He scanned my body, looking for injuries. A look of relief crossed his face.
Thank God, he said.
I offered him a smile before turning my attention to the shifters.
Aren't you kids a little outnumbered? I asked.
When they turned to look at me, Ethan took advantage of their distraction, sending 2 of them to the ground with lethal slashes. I edged around the other two, putting myself between them and Ethan. Unfortunately, the perpetrators picked that moment to call out to four or five of their friends, who appeared at the door with weapons, guns, and what looked like pieces of Cadogan House furniture in hand. They realized they had us cornered and began to work their flanks, encircling us so that we stood in the middle of them. "Back to back," I told him, and he nodded, then turned so we stood with our backs together, our swords horizontal in front of us, surrounded by foes. And then we fought. Whatever miracle of vampire genetics I might have been was nothing compared to the miracle of our fighting, together. We both swung out, the magic and power surrounding us seeming to actually increase as we fought, bullets flying as we battled back the interlopers who'd threatened our home. The master of Cadogan House and its sentinel, their steel honed, tempered, and raised against a common foe. We made quick work of the first couple of attackers, but then they started getting creative, moving around to make it more difficult for Ethan and me to coordinate our movements, even when we could give each other silent directions. On the other hand, that also forced us to get a little more creative. Eventually, we were fighting side by side, Ethan slicing out with his katana to keep an attacker off balance, and me kicking him into submission. Ethan would spin into a high kick, and I'd use a low throw to force him to the ground when he tried to dodge Ethan's attack. Eventually, the room was cleared, and we stood there together, chests heaving, a spray of shifters and humans on the floor in front of us. We weren't entirely undamaged. I'd taken a bruising shot to my right thigh, and Ethan had slices across his belly where he'd been caught with the edge of a bar of steel broken from someone's office chair. But we were alive. We glanced over at each other. I was just about to speak, but before I could get out the words, his hand was at the back of my head, his mouth pressing against mine. The intensely possessive kiss left me gasping for breath. But even as he pulled back, his fingers stayed knotted in the back of my hair. "Christ, Merritt, I thought you were dead. You left after we talked, and no one could find you. And when they attacked, you didn't show. Where the hell were you?" "I was at the bar," I said. "I'll give you the details later. Long story short, this is all Adam's doing. He set it all up, had a plan to kill Gabriel and frame the house." Ethan smiled wickedly. "And you figured it out before Adam could take you both out. But he'd already started the attack." "Well, I am the Cadogan Sentinel." "Indeed you are," he said, then kissed me with brutal force again. "This isn't over," he growled. Then he was gone, ready for battle again. I wasn't going to waste the time arguing with him. But as soon as his back was turned, I raised my fingertips to my mouth, the feel of his lips still there. I could feel it coming. The sun wasn't far from making its way above the horizon, and it had begun to pull at my shoulders. Fortunately, the combined strength of the Chicago Police Department, the Chicago Fire Department, the Ombuds Office, half the North American Central Pack, the Vampires of Cadogan House, and the Red Guard had finally managed to stop the attack. Ethan seemed to take the Red Guard's participation in stride. He didn't bat an eyelash when he saw them, but he also didn't have a reason to tie their presence to me. That meant if I decided to join them, I could still keep my secret under wraps. But positives aside, the house wasn't without its casualties. 7 shifters and humans had been killed in the attack. We lost 3 vampires. I didn't know any of them to speak of, although 2 lived on the 2nd floor, not far from my room. 2 were lost to wooden stakes, their ashen remains now mingled with the destruction in the house. The 3rd, however, had met a more gruesome end. She'd been the victim of an old-fashioned torture. A crazed human attacker, one of the deceased, weakened her with an ill-placed stake and removed her heart. In honor of her sacrifice, her body had been placed in the garden behind the house, to be given to the sun when it finally breached the sky. As for Cadogan itself, the Moderators had worked to bring down the house around us,
While the sturdy stone and construction had thwarted the worst of the damage, the furnishings and woodwork on the first and second floors had been damaged. Some of the rooms rendered uninhabitable. Helen and Malik had been working the phones, making arrangements with Gray, Navarre, and the other Katagun vamps in Chicago to find temporary homes for vamps whose rooms had been torched or were too wet and smoky to stay in. My room, in a back corridor of the second floor, had fortunately been spared. As an ombudsman, my grandfather had jurisdiction over the city's response to the chaos. He helped sort out the good shifters from the bad, explaining the politics to any CPD cop he could corral long enough. He managed to keep them from arresting every shifter and vampire in sight. Given the destruction and chaos, I called that a victory. Unfortunately, he hadn't been able to keep the paparazzi from snapping pictures. They didn't venture into Katagun House, but they hadn't needed to. One of Adam's shifters had been so grievously wounded in human form that he'd shifted in the middle of the front lawn to heal himself. I might have been the first vampire to witness the shifting of a pack member, but I hadn't been the last, and the paparazzi wouldn't be the last either. They'd reportedly snap pictures of the biker turned coyote, and the biker turning into a coyote. Having seen the transformation myself, I doubted the final photographs would show much more than lights and colors. Regardless, it was obvious to the reporters that something supernatural had happened, something they hadn't seen before, and that set off a journalistic feeding frenzy. That's why my grandfather, at Gabriel's request, had cordoned the reporters into an area in front of the house. He stood behind a makeshift podium, Gabriel at his side, a bevy of uniformed cops surrounding them. Waiting. Gabriel raised his hands, and the crowd of reporters quieted just as the shifters had the night before.
"I have something to say," he announced, then used the back of his hand to push a trail of blood from his eyes.
He paused, the weight of the looming confession in his eyes. I knew what he was going to say, but I also knew what it would cost him, emotionally and politically.
"You'll soon see pictures that tell quite a tale, that prove that vampires are not the only supernatural beings in the world." "We are shapeshifters," he said, "beings who can take animal or human form."
Ethan stood beside me, and at the mention of the magic word, slid his fingers into mine. I squeezed back. The area erupted into a cacophony of camera flashes and questions. Gabriel ignored them, holding up a hand again so he could continue speaking.
"We are shifters, and some of my number are responsible for this attack on Katagun House, an attack on a band of citizens who have done nothing but assist and protect us. This attack was unjustified. We have already submitted the organizer of this attack into the custody of the Chicago Police Department. As he has violated the trust between our peoples, you may deal with him as you deem fit."
He paused, letting the weight of that statement sink in. And when he was ready, he looked into the crowd and found Ethan and me.
"And may God have mercy on us all."
A few minutes before dawn, I found Ethan in his office, poking through rubble. The ruined curtains had already been replaced by shabbier models, the switch necessary to block the coming sunlight. He glanced up when I walked in, then scanned my face and body.
"You're all right?"
I nodded. "As much as anyone can be. I'm sorry about the novitiates you lost today." Ethan nodded, then righted the chair that had been flipped onto its side.
"It's not unforeseen that we would face violence, but that doesn't make the violent act any less shocking."
He put a hand on his hip, then rubbed his temple with the fingers of his free hand.
"I spoke with your grandfather about the events at the bar. Nick filled him in."
I waited for the inevitable lecture about leaving campus, or engaging in shifter vampire dialogue without permission, or putting the house at risk.
"Well," he philosophically said, "Adam isn't the first narcissist to have put us in a bind. Has everyone been resettled?"
It took me a moment to realize I hadn't been chastised. Scott and Morgan sent buses to pick up everyone. There's about a dozen vampires at each house. The rest of them are tucked in and accounted for. The front wing of the second floor needs airing out, but the fairies have agreed to keep guard so workmen can get started at dawn. He nodded officially, but didn't meet my eyes. It was clear he had more to say, but he hadn't quite gotten around to it. "Is there anything else?" I asked, giving him the chance to voice his thoughts. Ethan opened his mouth, but then snapped it shut again. "We can talk tomorrow. Find a spot to rest. Get some sleep." I nodded. "Good night, Sullivan."
"Good night, Sentinel."
My evenings were beginning to have the same endings, it seemed. Epilogue. The best offense isn't a good defense.
It's a good offense.
When I woke up the next evening, my assorted cuts and scrapes were gone. But the house, I knew, would still wear scars. I got up and showered, scrubbing off soot and dried blood I'd been too exhausted to clean at dawn. Expecting to rehab and reorganize the house, I dressed down, jeans, t-shirt, and pumas, my hair in a ponytail, the ever-present Katagun medal around my neck, in case I suddenly forgot whom my allegiances were to. But there was no chance of that. Whatever our personal issues, Ethan and I had proven we worked well together. We even fought well together. I'd had enough jobs and glimpses of my father butting heads with his staff that I knew what a rarity that was. Our personal issues notwithstanding, we were good colleagues. And just as he had chosen not to risk the professional by dabbling in the personal, I had my own sacrifice to make. I couldn't leave my house without a sentinel in the middle of a war. So I found Noah's phone number and dialed. He answered after two rings.
"Beck, it's Merritt."
"Sentinel," he said, his voice gravelly. "How are things at the house?"
"We're putting things back together."
"I'm glad to hear it. It's going to take time, but I'm glad to hear it. I can't thank you enough for what you did last night. For showing up. For sacrificing your anonymity, for helping us fight.
The time comes when we all have to sacrifice."
He was almost too right. "About your offer, I'm declining." There was silence for a moment.
"I'll be honest. I'm surprised to hear that."
"My loyalty is to the house," I explained. I'd chosen, as my grandmother once taught me, to dance with the one who brought me.
"Things can always change," Noah said, "but we may not have a slot if you wait."
"I understand the risk," I assured him, "and thank you for making the offer, even if I have to say no."
"Well, it would have been interesting. Good luck with the renovations."
"Good evening, Noah." I hung up the phone, then squeezed it in my hand. "Well," I murmured, "I suppose that's that." There was a knock at the door. I assumed it was Lindsay, coming to gather me up for breakfast and rehab work, so I opened it without hesitation. It was Ethan. He was back in jeans, paired again with a t-shirt and dark boots. I guess our master was ready for work as well.
"How are you feeling?"
"Well healed," I told him. "You?"
"So far, so good."
"Excellent."
"Mm-hmm."
We stood there for a moment, the pink elephant dancing around us as we studiously worked to avoid her. Ethan held out his hand. In his palm was a glossy blue box with a silver C engraved on the top. Brow furrowed, I took it from him.
"What's this?" "An apology, of sorts."
I made a moo, but slipped the lid from the top. And then my breath left me. Inside the box sat a baseball, its well-worn white leather marked by the signatures of every Cubs player from the team. It was just like the one I'd had, just like the one I'd told him about the night we made love. I blinked down at the box, trying to take in the gravity of the gift.
"What? Where did you get this?"
Ethan slid his hands into his pockets.
"I have my sources."
"You shouldn't have. He stopped me with his hand at my jaw, thumb against my chin.
Sometimes people must adapt. Immortality doesn't make the things we love less important. It means we must learn to treasure them, protect them. I swallowed hard and made myself lift my gaze to him, fear and joy and more fear bursting in my chest. "It is an apology," he said, "for not believing in you or in us. Yesterday, I thought I'd lost you, and then we fought together," he said. "I pushed you away for fear of what our relationship would do, could do, to this house. And then we protected this house together. That is the true measure of what we could do." He paused, then tapped a finger against the box. "This is a wish," he said quietly, "that even after 400 years of existence, a man can be strong enough to accept the gifts he's given."
"Ethan," I began, but he shook his head.
"I'm prepared to wait for a positive response."
"That's going to take a while."
Ethan lifted a single eyebrow, a grin lifting one corner of his mouth.
"Sentinel, I am immortal."
He turned on his heel and began down the hall, then called back.
"And we'll need to chat about your running off campus and into the arms of shifters without so much as a telephone call."
Sometimes he was so predictable.
This concludes Twice Bitten.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.